Hi, I'm Patrick, and I just ate at Honey Butter Fried Chicken in Avondale, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 1022. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. The wonderful Bob Ferguson is here with us today. He is our engineer on duty in the WGN radio studio. And look, we all know that there is a lot of money in politics. Lots of things that politicians are paying for. And the Sun-Times put this out a couple days ago. They looked at some expenditures over the last 20 and 30 years, looking at really nice restaurants. When politicians go out for, as they say, swanky meals, sometimes the campaign funds are going to pay for that. Now, to be clear, this isn't taxpayer money, so this is strictly through their campaigns. But, you know, think about this when you're donating to a political campaign, if you do that. So far this year, more than $200,000 was spent by campaign funds on what was described as a quote-unquote meal, according to the Elections Board. Last year, the total was around $900,000. And you look at some of these numbers here. Restaurants like Gibson's and Rosebud, man, they made out. Over $800,000 was spent at Rosebud restaurants over the last couple of decades. So there's that. And look, sometimes they're not always going to high-end restaurants. If you go back three decades, more than $3 million involve expenditures at establishments with pizza in their name. Oh, here's one. Hooters. More than $50,000 was spent at Hooters locales since 2001, with more than $40,000 of that spent at a Lansing franchise by State Representative Thaddeus Jones, who doubles as the mayor of Calumet City. All right. And where I'm from originally, Elmwood Park, the mayor, Skip Saviano, he spent more than $250,000 in what's described in his disclosure reports as meals and entertainment since 2013, including expenditures of more than $60,000 at Gibson's locations and over $25,000 at Chicago Cut that date back even longer. Dude, you're from Elmwood Park. Spend some of that money on Johnny's. Spend some of that money on Alpine. Those small businesses would love that. To be clear, nothing was illegal here. No rules were broken. But I just, I got to think that these restaurants love that, right? They're businesses, politicians. You're helping them stay afloat. So good for you, I think. Enjoy those nice dinners. Stick around. We've got a great show for you today. Speaking of local businesses, how about those local grocery stores? They could be struggling here in Illinois. We will explore that. Also, a local music education program and the secret history of a really cool blues guitarist who spent a lot of time in Chicago. It's all coming up next. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Or maybe there is. Changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, will have an impact on Illinois starting this month. Not just for thousands who are hoping to afford food, but those who sell the food. Independent grocers in the state could face debt and potential store closures because fewer people might not be able to buy their food. Jenna Schweikert is a State House reporting intern at Capital News Illinois. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service covering state government. And she recently wrote a piece about this issue up at capitalnewsillinois.com. She joins us today here on Outside the Loop. Jenna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So I kind of set it up there, but if you can explain a little bit more of the backstory, this issue is really existing because of the federal cuts to food assistance, right?
Yeah, exactly. So last summer when HR 1 passed, it made some changes to the SNAP program. And so this May, we've been seeing some people be kicked off the program and lose their benefits because of these new work requirements.
And that's also known as the One Big Beautiful Bill, in case people don't know what HR 1 is. But those work requirements here, so that means that there is a little bit more to do, or maybe some potential barriers or hurdles that people might encounter when trying to apply for SNAP. And that might sound like, oh, big deal, prove that you're working. But sometimes there's a level of bureaucracy there that it's not always easy, right?
Yeah, exactly. What we're seeing is that people are struggling to provide documentation. In Illinois, we've seen about an 8% decrease from 2025 SNAP enrollment to 2026. So it's still pretty early. We could see that number increase over the coming months as people adjust to these new work requirements and try to submit some of those documents that prove that they're working or that they have an exemption from those requirements.
And so looking at grocery stores themselves, I mean, having a grocery store is just a tough job to begin with. And then you factor in if you are an independent, maybe smaller grocery store, and we see a lot of those across the state of Illinois. Can you just explain how difficult of a business this is and how these small grocers are really struggling to get by as is, even before these cuts?
Yeah. So when I talked to some advocates for this article, what I found out was that grocery stores have some of the slimmest profit margins of any business. And that's for a lot of different reasons. One is that it's really expensive to run a grocery store in Illinois, especially. Energy prices are really high. They have electricity, fridges, freezers, all these things. And then they also operate in what they call the penny business, which means that they rely on selling a lot of low-priced product and not, they don't have really big purchases that can make up those profits. And they also have this issue where a lot of their product is also perishable. So produce, for example, there's a lot of loss there. So to begin with, they have a really hard time just breaking even. And so they can't really afford to lose any of the revenue that they have to begin with.
And so now if we put all of this together, so if it's harder to get this food assistance and fewer people in the state are doing that, then maybe they don't go to grocery stores and buy as much food as they were doing when they had that assistance. And as you just said, these grocery stores really can't afford to lose any customers here. Their profit margins are like 1-2%, as you report in your piece. Can you just take us through what some of these grocery store owners are saying and that worry of how this is going to impact their bottom line?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different things that could happen. We talked about the shutdown last fall. Some SNAP recipients didn't get their benefits, and so it was kind of a test run for seeing how SNAP cuts were going to affect grocery stores this summer. And what happened is that when some owners couldn't necessarily meet their bills or they had emergencies, like they have to buy a new refrigerator or something like that, they might end up going into debt or are putting a lot of money on a credit card that they just pay off later, but they don't necessarily have the revenue later either. And so what we might see happen is these independent grocery stores close. And there's some concern that that could expand food deserts and limit people's access to healthy, fresh food in their community.
And so when we look at that possibility here, I know that some folks at the state government level are talking about what the state government can do. So what is that conversation like? Are there ideas being put forward and really in a position that they could be debated or advanced in our local government?
Yeah, they're talking about it, but it is a pretty difficult situation because lawmakers are really trying to save a lot of money this year because we're seeing expenses everywhere. And so it's hard to pass bills that are just spending more money, even though it's a service that people might need. And at the end of the day, the issue is coming from a federal program. And so when I talked to advocates, they said, you know, the only thing that could really fix this is if people have easier access to SNAP, if we revisit some of these changes. But what state lawmakers are trying to do are pass these three different bills that would help some people who have been kicked off SNAP. One of them would give out one-time payment. The other would extend eligibility of state food assistance, things like that. So there are things that the state can do, but it only goes so far at the end of the day.
Yeah, this is an issue that, sure, it affects people who are maybe struggling to make ends meet in terms of being able to buy food. They're affected, but then the grocery stores and the owners of those grocery stores, especially those independent, smaller grocery stores in Illinois, they might feel the squeeze as well. And we will, of course, be monitoring this. I know you will be at Capital News Illinois, and we can check out what Jenna Schweikert is writing at capitalnewsillinois.com. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service covering state government. Jenna is a State House reporting intern for Capital News Illinois. Jenna, thank you so much for talking to us today. This is a really important issue, and I'm glad you're covering it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Music is so important to our culture, and in order to preserve this art form, we need to provide music instruction and performance opportunities. That's what the organization Timeless Gifts is all about. We could check out the website timelessgifts.org. It's a locally based nonprofit, and Joan Colasso is the founder of Timeless Gifts. She's also an Emmy Award winning vocalist, and she is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Joan, nice to talk to you.
It is such a pleasure to talk to you, Mike. Thank you so much for calling.
You are very welcome. So I think this is really cool. I mean, I love music. I know you love music. And anytime we can talk about music, but also get music out to more people and opportunities to perform, I think that's great. So tell us a little bit more about this nonprofit. Again, it's called Timeless Gifts. What are you setting out to achieve here?
Okay, so it is called Timeless Gifts officially, but the entire title is Timeless Gifts Performing Arts Program for Youth and Young Adults. And so what we are aiming to do is to open up avenues for young people and even all the way up to the ages of the early 20s, give them performance opportunities, give them opportunities to interface with professional musicians and tech people, and have sessions with them about professional etiquette, trying to build in a passion for not just doing music and performing arts, but being a good person.
Mm. And I know that, you know, sometimes in the music industry, we hear stories about how the business aspect can go down. So, you know, you're talking about opportunities for young people to perform and learn how to read music, play instruments, get that stage experience. But also there's the production element, too. So thinking about video and audio and kind of navigating the whole sphere of music, that's kind of what you're focusing on, right?
Yes. If that's what their interest is, what we do is we make it available to them whatever they are interested in. So say, for instance, your kid is into singing. A lot of young people who are into singing. We have singing instructors, and we have performances that they can do. But if your kid is interested in production, that's a little unique for a young person.
Yeah.
And so what we do is we pair them with one of our production people so that they can kind of follow along and see, you know, what that process is and learn from the professional.
And I know that you have some summer programs coming up here. I think this starts in June, so it starts next month. So tell us about what's coming up here. How can people get involved, and what are you planning for the summer?
Okay, so we have a 7-week summer program in which you can take lessons. You can take sessions based around certain concepts like production, like professional etiquette, like learning the terminology and the protocols of being in the performing arts so that we know how to step and not misstep when we're in a professional setting, things like that. And so it's a 7-week summer program that we craft for three groups of kids. We have our tinies. Mm-hmm. From 3 to 7, they're just there having a good old time and just getting used to not being shy. And, you know, some of them are incredible.
Yeah.
And then we have our, what we call our GEMs, G-E-M, and they're age 8 to 15. And that's our largest group. And they are taking lessons, they're dancing, they're tap dancing. They're doing percussion, whatever they desire to do it. And we've been doing it so long that we have people in place to give them lessons and things like that. But also they will study these general subjects together as a group. And then our oldest group is our all-stars. Many of them have been with us a long time, and their age is 16 to 24. And we're able to offer them possible job opportunities, you know, as long as they last. We have a kind of a first come, first serve situation where they can come, perform, have a good time, learn, study under a professional instructor and all of that while getting paid.
That's great. So you've got CineCity Studios in Chicago. That's where all this takes place, a wonderful facility
this
there.
This is where the summer program takes place,
Yeah, the summer program taking place there. So, okay, if people want to get involved, do they just go to the website, timelessgifts.org?
Yeah, so for young people who want to be in the program, there's a big sign on the homepage that says, apply here. Click that, fill out the form. Someone will be in touch with you.
All right. So we should check out the website, timelessgifts.org. This is a great local music and art education program. It's taking place this summer at the CineCity Studios in Chicago. And again, that website is timelessgifts.org. And Joan Colasso is the founder of the nonprofit organization Timeless Gifts, based in Chicago. She's also an Emmy Award-winning vocalist. Joan, thank you so much for talking to us today. And thanks for providing this wonderful opportunity for creativity for so many young people in Chicago.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Oh yeah, once again connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader. He's also known as Plastic Crime Wave. He's a local music historian, musician, and artist. And this week, Steve, we are learning about Luther Guitar Jr. Johnson. He is a blues man. And he is so talented. He's going to play with some, here we go again. He's going to play with some big names.
Totally. And yeah, a classic Chicago blues guitarist who, you know, I think he gets lost in the shuffle a little bit because there was another amazing Chicago blues guitarist, Luther Johnson. Snake Boy was his nickname, and I covered him a while back, and I remember noting that there were two of them, you know, I was like, wow. And they both play with Muddy Waters, which, you know, like, a few years apart. But it was like, wow. I mean, try to look up one of them and you get some information on the other one I found, you know. So I was like, OK, quite a formidable dude in his own right with a epic career and great sound, and played with like so many greats.
Yes, he did. We're talking about Luther Johnson, Luther Guitar Jr. Johnson, just to be clear. And he is from the Mississippi Delta. We've talked about a bunch of blues musicians, Steve, who have a similar story. They're from the Delta. He was born in Mississippi in April of 1939, and he is living and coming up in the Jim Crow era in the South. He's, his parents were sharecroppers, and it's a story of, you know, he's going to work more often than going to school because he's in the fields. And I mean, he's working like almost around the clock from sun up to sundown. It's one of these stories of just like really cutting your teeth on some hard times.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was a fairly hard life, but, you know, the escape or, you know, thing they yearned for was the church and music, and those things sort of came early on together. Like a lot of bluesmen, you know, he was started like singing and performing in the church, and, you know, as we've said, gospel's like a, you know, you can't be no slouch to sing gospel and such. Like, you're going to get your chops, and as well as just, you know, entertaining people at house parties and such like that. So, you know, he was interested in music at an early age.
That's right. So he is playing in church, and he gets into music very young, and he is from a very young age very fascinated by the power of blues music, and he has a guitar since 11 years old, and he is on a school trip going to Memphis, and he sees Muddy Waters, B.B. King, and the Staples Singers. That's a great school trip.
I mean, wow. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it sounds like, you know, other blues musician would come to you from this little, pretty little town called Minter City. But, you know, like Little Walter, Otis Band, you know, people, they would come through even when he was really young. I guess he'd hang outside and like to hear rehearsals because he couldn't really get into the shows or whatever. So, like, you know, just... It sounds like from everything he was like, from an early age, like, I am going to make music. I'm going to, even like, he was basically like, I'm going to go to Chicago. Like, it sounds like he romanticized Chicago because he knew that's where all these artists were from. And it was like, you know, I'm going to go there. I'm going to make some myself a music one day. It was like self fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, he wanted to get to Chicago, and he said he's going to play with Muddy Waters, and people are going to pay to come see him. And boy, he was pretty accurate with that. He does get to Chicago, like you said. He kind of romanticizes it, but he's going to get up here and let's talk about what happens when he comes up here, because this is when, you know, Chicago was really just the place for blues. And so Luther Johnson's going to get up here, and this is where stuff is going to start to really pop for him.
Yeah, I mean, he's just pretty much catching a bus. Sounds like he had to go like in the middle of nowhere to get this bus, you know, to get up to Chicago. Two of his sisters had moved up here, so it sounds like on the weekends he'd sort of like come up and babysit / explore the town. And then, you know, when he just saw how crazy it was up here and how much music was going on, you know, pretty much moved to Chicago. And his sisters also lived above a club, and he was underage, but they kind of like disguised him and got him in there and got him on stage singing. And it sounds like it was like sort of like he picked up steam from there, you know, pretty much.
And he's getting a band. I mean, he gets a band together and he's playing around Chicago. And, you know, it's not exactly glamorous. He says the money was pretty bad, and the scene sometimes got pretty rough around here during those times.
Man, that was everywhere. I was reading a book recently on another a jazz guy who sort of intermingled and played in the blues and R&B crowd. And this was in Oakland, and then he played in New York. Same story. It seemed like everyone was carrying like a straight razor. You know, like, I mean, seriously, it was the same thing. It was like someone whipped out a straight razor and just went to town on somebody, you know, and you're just like, so it sounds like he learned to be streetwise and carry protection, you know, playing in these sort of rough clubs. And the other thing is, like, you had to really entertain people too. You know, it sounds like he joined Bobby Rush's band after playing gigs with him and his first combo. And it's like, you had to put on a show. You had to be jumping all over the place and, you know, doing acrobatic moves and getting in the crowd and really working, you know, like people, they didn't take anything half-assed, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's Chicago for you, right?
Yeah, right.
So
right.
He's working just a bunch of day jobs, construction. He's working transit. He's working at a steel mill. He's working at Children's Memorial Hospital. He's working at a restaurant. And this is about the time in the 1960s and into the 1970s where he starts to really kind of make a name for himself. I know his first record comes out in 1970 that he records in 1968. But tell us how he kind of gets his break here.
I think the big one, and, you know, and I think it continued through his whole career, that his love of the man was Magic Sam, who, you know, with one of the first Secret Histories I ever did 20 years ago. If you know, you know. He's sort of like the king of the West Side, like electric Chicago blues sound. Like for guitar, he was the guy. You know, like Muddy was like the voice and the personality, but like Sam, you know, Wolf too. You know, but Magic Sam, he's the man. He's the man. So he was invited to play in his band. It sounds like he wasn't even taking it terribly seriously because he's getting drunk a lot. He admitted that in the interview I read with him. And he's like, oh, man, it sounds like Magic Sam wanted to fire him like every show. But then he was also a good singer, Johnson. So like he would go up there, do a great performance and be like, all right, you're hired back. You know, so it's, you know, it's sort of a classic tale there. But and then, yeah, he was basically finally starting to record a little bit under his own name, you know, by 70. I think it was recorded in 68, but he's got a killer band on it. He's got like Jimmy Dawkins on guitar, who was an amazing dude. This guy, Johnny Big Moose Walker, who I covered a while back. And he does a Magic Sam song. And, you know, he would sort of continue to pay tribute to Sam, like, you know, the whole rest of his career.
And as you say, the most momentous job in Luther Guitar Jr. Johnson's career comes in December of 1973. This is when he's going to join Muddy Waters' band. I mean, he wanted to play with Muddy when he was a lot younger, and he, you know, kind of called it like, hey, I'm going to play with Muddy Waters and everyone's going to pay to come see me. And this is coming true in 1973.
Yeah. And, you know, and that band stayed for a while there, you know, almost 10 years or something. You know, a pretty celebrated version of the band. He got called by his buddy Calvin Fuzz Jones, another guy I covered a while back who was seemed really cool. And this other dude, Bob Margolin, was in the band then. And, you know, I guess Muddy himself said it was like one of his favorite versions of his band.
It's a pity. People, ain't just a crying shame.
He is going to put out an all-acoustic record in 2020, and unfortunately, he's going to pass away in 2022.
Yeah, not too long ago, and then I do remember hearing about it. I think that was a messed up time in the world, one, isn't it? But
yeah, right.
And you know, but before that, he was on kind of like he was in a sort of Muddy Waters tribute band, and whenever he'd run into Chicago cats, it seems like, you know, he would record and jam with them and stuff. So he never really forgot his roots, you know, he even to the end.
Well, he is one cool dude, the late, great Luther Guitar Jr. Johnson. That is who is profiled in the Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. So we can check out the full version of that column. And Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave, is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music. He's also a local musician, music historian, and artist. And I love the blues. We all love the blues, Steve, right? The blues are they're great. And Luther Johnson, part of that history.
And just remember, kids, if you will it to be, if you say, I'm going to play a Muddy Waters band, you can make it happen.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 1022 is done. Thank you very much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.